Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. Alan Jackson, joining me from Texas. I think Alan Jackson's from Oklahoma, if I recall, but joining me from Texas is Tim Lynch. Tim, how you doing on a Thursday? What's going on?
Not much, brother. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
All right. Always good to hear your voice. And joining us is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
I'm good, Max. How are you?
I'm you know what? My back's fucked up, man, and I've been fighting it all week. It's long. I've done it before, kind of like a muscle strain in my low back, and so every time I get up or try to move, like, it's like I have muscle spasms. I don't know, man. It hurts, so...
So might be that your lower discs down there.
Let's hope not. So, yeah, I mean, I've had it before, and it normally goes after a few days, and so I'm hoping it's nothing.
As it goes, does the pain radiate down your leg?
No, just stays local. So
I had something similar several times. It's not fun.
Yeah, so I mean, what takes care of it is just, you know, lying flat on the floor. Right, and then getting a roller out and rolling it, and then kind of doing some yoga stuff, you know, like just, you know, arching your back both forward and backwards to make sure you move around and you don't, you know, almost kind of stay sedentary and let it lock up on you. So I'm, you know, but this has lasted a little bit longer than it normally does, which pisses me off. So anyway, I've been, I've been fighting that. And then, was in Quantico, last time I talked to you, I was in Quantico. So that was kind of interesting. And, saw some of our friends, saw Mike Killian, walked down the corner.
Cool.
I haven't seen Killer since, you know, since the basic school.
Wow.
Yeah. And walked around the corner and went, holy shit. But no kidding. But had a great conversation with Mike Killian, nickname obviously Killer, Naval Academy guy, boxer guy, smart guy, funny guy, like most of our friends. Saw him and had a good time. Had a good time. My nephew's headed to IOC this week.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So had dinner with him a couple times and. Got to see my younger son back there, so it was a good trip. Got a chance to see Sergeant Major Barrett. Did either one of you guys serve with him?
No, I met him when I went to a Medal of Honor thing.
No, I have not.
Right. No, I didn't serve with him either, but I met him through Sergeant Major Zickafoos. And so had a great conversation with him about post-traumatic winning. And so pretty cool stuff. So anyway, let's talk about Iran again. How is this thing playing out? I was watching an interview with, he must be what, the prime minister of Iran? Yeah, Chris Wallace interviewed him, and you know, and it's crazy to watch these interviews, and where he straight up like looks in the camera and says, "Yeah, like I don't care what anybody says, we did not shoot those missiles."
Yeah,
and you're just going, okay, yeah, you know, just you know, like you know, and he makes you know, and he makes these points about the United States is conducting an economic war against Iran and all these things and. And then you could actually, you know, say, well, okay, I can see how they would see that. And then when he gets asked, well, what about missiles being launched against Saudi Arabia from Iran? And he just looks and says, yeah, that didn't happen. She's just like, all right, now we're going to do cartoons. So, Let's get your thoughts. So, Jeff, another week has gone by. Is this thing playing out true to form? One of the interesting things I saw was that Saudi Arabia won't specifically name Iran in public. They will let other people do it because Saudi Arabia knows that Iran would kick its ass.
Yeah.
And so I'd just be curious, what you've read, what you've seen, what do you think now relative to the whole Saudi Arabia-Iranian thing?
Well, I think it's they're going to have to make the first move because the president's speech yesterday, he didn't leave them any room, really. I mean, he always says, you know, people can talk to us, and we're always willing to do that, but there's no indicators that we're going to, you know, lessen, you know, give them any leeway on the sanctions. And he even said during that interview with Wallace that these are hurting regular people, you know.
Right.
But that's the idea, you know, that the at least it's hurting somebody, and it's not just hurting regular people. Because if it was just hurting regular people, he wouldn't give a shit, you know. It's hurting them. And that's why, you know, this thing is going the way it is. I don't think they're getting the reaction that they expected. Like, they expected some kind of weak-ass quid pro quo from the U.S. military, you know, hitting them something that wasn't really too valuable. And what they got instead was more tightening of the screws on the sanctions, which is, that's the opposite of what they want. So, I mean, it's up to our imagination, and possibly some intelligence, you know, apparatus that we have knows it. But there's probably a faction in Iran that's going, see, this is the opposite, having the opposite effect. And you know, so they're, I sense that. And even if I'm wrong, too bad.
Well, I don't know. You know, to me, he's playing charades because he was not a part of the decision making for that which was launched. It was the IRGC, and he's out there standing there holding the bag for it.
Yeah,
but I think it was done for. The more I thought about it throughout the course of the week, I mean, to me, the only thing the reason it would be done is for internal consumption. But anyway, Timmy, your thoughts? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it was 3 weeks ago, Jeff pointed out that there are different components of the Iranian government who do not cooperate with each other, who act independently. And then 2 weeks ago, you start seeing articles in the press about the ICRG might have done this in order to tie the president's hands, lest he try to make a deal with Trump. I find that kind of interesting. So I think that our instincts have been right all along. As I looked this last week to kind of confirm what's going on, or just to get a sense for what's going on inside the country, what comes up is articles about Iranians selling their body organs in order to get money, and drought, drought, drought. So whether this is information being planted by Iran in the media in order to press its case, or it's legitimate facts on the ground, it sure appears like the screws are getting put on them. And I remember in 2005 when I did a food survey down there in Western Afghanistan, everywhere you went, you saw flour with gift to the people of Iran from the people of Canada. It was everywhere. So they used to get tons of, they've always gotten aid. They used to use that aid to smuggle it across and raise money. I don't think they're going to be doing that anytime soon, quite frankly, given the drought conditions that they're facing.
So we've talked in the past about this being for internal consumption in Iran, and as Tim just said, tying the hands of their president in terms of making a deal with the United States. Jeff, have your thoughts changed about that?
No, I'll tell you, the whole thing is bizarre because the stuff that's going on with our domestic politics, at the same time the president's there duking it out at the U.N., that speech he made yesterday was historic. I mean, he didn't give any, just flat out told the truth, you know, about one by one, all these bad actors. And all, I mean, everything from border secure, open borders people all the way through Iran and, you know, and Russia and so forth. So it's like, you know, but I wonder, it's bizarre, you know, these foreign leaders must be thinking, wow, this guy's not even showing, he's not in the least showing any kind of, like, preoccupation with the fact that, you know, they're yelling about impeachment right under his nose. The very day he's doing that, you know, with them. He just doesn't care. And they're like, they're nonplussed by a guy who just, he's like, hey, I can handle all of this.
But, okay, so the answer to, have your thoughts changed about this being for internal consumption in Iran?
No, I think it is. I think a lot of They think, well, it's like they want to show them that they're doing something, but it's not having any effect. So to show somebody, to show the, you know, the internal audience that you're doing something, and then things get worse, that has the opposite effect of what they intended. So they're casting about. I think the whole attack on the Saudis oil thing was a desperation move. Well, you're desperate.
Yeah, to me, the more you look at it, the more desperate that it does look. I agree with you. My thoughts haven't changed at all because, as you said, I mean, it's a head scratcher because if you were trying to court the favor of Europe, right, you just had France, Germany, and the UK in a joint statement all blame Iran. So, it was France, Germany, and... Because the UK did it separately. France, Germany, and I thought somebody else came out and said that they believe. Timmy, have your thoughts changed in any nuanced way? You just said that you still believe that, but any nuances to it?
Well, I had contended that a lot of what was going on was also targeted towards France and Germany, which are the two countries which continually having the past flat out defy the bans, and continue to push back. But as you pointed out, France did join Germany and specifically blame them for Saudi oil attacks. Not that big of a deal, quite frankly, but it was rather obvious. But I believe I don't think France and Germany are down with cooperating with us to any large degree. And what really upsets me is exactly what Jeff just pointed out. President Trump went to the UN and told people in straight talk what they'd never heard from an American president before. Nobody heard that last night here in America. All they heard was impeachment, impeachment, impeachment. I think it works for to our disadvantage in that the people overseas don't perceive Trump legitimately. Because everything the Democrats are doing are cutting at his legitimacy. So the fact that he's able to exercise any kind of a damn foreign relationship is a miracle right now. But he's doing it, and quite frankly, I'm amazed that he is. I voted for him, but I didn't think he'd be able to do what he's apparently doing, which is holding the Iranians to the fire, holding the Chinese to the feet to the fire, and pressuring France and pressuring Germany and saying, hey, don't even fucking talk to me until you put 2% into your defense. Don't even talk to me. And what is wrong with that? I don't see anything wrong with that.
Wait, that wasn't the question, though. The question was back to your love affair with Trump, okay? We have to dial that down again already. Well, the question was, you don't see any nuances or in the internal consumption piece of the Iranian thing.
No. I am now solidly behind Jeff. I don't think right now the Iranians can even think about trying to toy with France and German public perceptions. They're on their ass.
All right. Let me ask you, the mishap investigation came out, the F-18. Let's see, it was FA-18 Delta midair with the KC-130J. That investigation came out. Jeff, I don't know if you had a chance to look at any of that. Any thoughts on that?
No, I didn't see that. I didn't see the investigation.
Got it. Timmy, did you see it?
I listened to you talking about that yesterday, and heard obviously what was going on with the refueling, the little bit of showboat, and boys wanted to go blasting by the tanker. Everybody's all excited to see a show that doesn't exist in NATOPS. It only exists in a goddamn Tom Cruise movie. It's a shame. It's a shame because you know the temptation is always there, but man, it's a shame.
It's
a discipline. It's a discipline issue. I mean, yeah, everybody wants to be a freaking hot dog and hit the afterburner and be cool. But you got to be disciplined in the damn plane because it will kill you if you're an idiot. And these guys apparently hit the idiot button.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's the most discouraging part about it. You know, we talk about discipline, you know, and again, I mean, across the force. And, you know, you know, what you have, and Jeff, you didn't see it, but it was they tank, and then when they're done, normally they reform on the starboard side of the, on the right side of the aircraft. They reform their flight, and then they climb and they pull to the right and they leave. That's the standard. So you come in from below the tanker to the left, you come into the tanking position, and then you reform off to the right. So there's this constant flow lower left to upper right. So Dash 2 is a pretty inexperienced pilot. I think he's got 17 hours in the F-18 at the squadron. The lead tells him, instead of, you know, they reform, and he tells him, hey, go get on the other side of the KC-130J, and as he's moving there, at some point he overcorrects and collides with the aft end of the KC-130J, and that sends them both into the water. And so,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so, and then, you know, it's a novice pilot. He was supposed to have done, you know, six different evolutions, tanking in order to be signed off. He did one and then got signed off by the guy who was the instructor. So there's a whole series of things relative to that that are, you look at them and you shake your head. You're like, you got to be kidding me. Six Marines dead, and that's the way we're doing business. So anyway.
Yes,
but that was big news because I've never seen an incident like that. I heard Joey Perrazzo talk he's an F-18 guy. He came on to explain stuff. He said we had a midair, the two F-18s that had just left that had formed up on the tanker. They collided in Iraq in 2005 and they lost both pilots, but he said, I don't remember an aircraft hitting the refueler ever. And so it's just something that, you know, in our careers have not seen. And so very curious as to, you know, what the hell caused it. So anyway.
You know, from doing two deployments or two Westpacs as a helicopter company, we were habitually associating with the HMM 46 squadrons with the 53s and the Cobra guys. Attached. And, you know, squadron officers were different than infantry officers. You could always find a good card game up there. Their wardrobes were plastered with Playboy pictures. You know, they on special occasions would break out booze, and they were kind of loosey-goosey, but I never knew them to be anything but deadly serious about NATOPS and training standards. It was weird how that sort of like this, the squadron norms of behavior were so professional in one area and so loosey-goosey at the other, and I attributed it all to Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff. I think they read that thing and everybody thinks that's what they got to do. But it was different, but they did not, you know, screw around with flying in NATOP schools at all.
Well, that's what Joey said. He said, you know, look, every time you go up there, you risk your life. But I will tell you this. I mean, my experience, right, with the helicopter that crashed into my assembly area, and I didn't know this till recently, that they made one pass because they were getting tracked by the LAB air defense variant, and that's why they were there, right? They were there to aggress the air defense platform so it could collect data. So they had made one pass, and I wasn't up on their UHF frequency, and I didn't have a FAC with me. So I didn't even know they were on station yet. You know, the first I saw them was when I saw the dust trail coming up Wood Canyon. And evidently they had made a previous pass, and the air defense guys said, and General Milstead told me this recently. He said, yeah, they made the first pass, and the air defense guy said, we tracked you the whole way. And what they got back was, oh, yeah? Well, watch this. And that's what... Right. I mean, the same kind of stuff that, in fact, another friend of mine, F-18 guy, listened to the interview yesterday. He said, you know, I thought when you were reading the part of the excerpt from the investigation that talked about, you know, the one of the last things that you hear, I guess, on a cockpit voice recorder from the KC-130 crew is, oh, they're going to blow by on both sides. That's really cool. Nobody ever does that anymore. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he says that, yeah. and then bad things happen.
Yeah, I went to WTI in 1996, and there was a Harrier pilot there, a young guy who was going through the course, and I was one of the ground guys. I went with Phil Scuda and Chris Woodbridge and a couple other dudes. And anyway, this kid, I tried to put him in the Marine Corps when I was an enlisted recruiter out of South High School in Pueblo. That's where he graduated high school. And he got a ROTC scholarship, so, you know, I didn't touch it. But he was doing a mission there, and his bomb went off before he could drop it underneath him. And so he was killed, and it was a big tragedy. And what I remember is there's, like, one death for every WTI class, it seemed like. Does that jive with what you guys remember? Or I don't know if it's still that way, but it was like... You know, somebody was always, because they really pushed the envelope in WTI. And we had some Task Force 160 guys there who had been in Somalia and Panama, same guys that were doing that Black Hawk Down stuff in Somalia. And they gave a pretty good PME at it. But what struck me was, we go to the club, and you know who else was there? Who was, I don't think he's a squadron commander, he's a senior pilot though. Remember the guy Walsh, who was at TBS I just showed up there after the Gulf War, and he was the first guy to get, like, a Bronze Star as LAD guy, and then he became a pilot. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
I do.
I don't.
I do.
Yeah.
He was there. I saw him. And I remember him, and we're in the club, and the CG was General McCorkle. You guys remember him?
No.
Fred McCorkle?
Yeah.
He's the E-Tool Smith of air wingers. He's a 46 guy. And, his wife was talking, his wife. And she's saying, you know, we got these new 7 Bravos a couple of years ago, and Fred was at the club, and on the way home, I don't want to dime the guy out, but his wife said, he turned the lights off in the car at, like, 11 o'clock at night, and he's just driving with the, with the NVGs on, and on their way home or something, you know, and she said, and I thought to myself, and this guy had a great rep, you know, he apparently... shot a guy's pistol out the window of his, out the window of his 46. He was trying to do a medevac or something in Vietnam. And I remember thinking, you know, we need guys like that. You need guys. That's not a good thing to do, obviously. But when sometimes your bombs go off underneath your Harrier, and or somebody else, you know, makes a mistake and you die for it, you need a certain type of individual to keep. You know, making sure that their skills are at the edge of their envelope, what they can be. And I mean, the first time I ever heard that phrase is like Timmy was saying when I read that book, Right Stuff, pushing the end of the edge of the envelope. You know?
Yeah, I don't know that I agree with that, man. I've seen the ugly end of you know what I'm saying? I mean. Let me tell you, it sounds real funny. Yeah, I shut my lights off and I put the MBGs on and I'm driving. What happens if you fuck that up with your wife in the car? You know what I mean? And so, I mean, just listen to that. And I hate to be that guy, you know, because, you know, I think our response is supposed to be, oh, that's so funny. I mean, I did that. I mean, it's one thing to fuck around with your own life. You know, and if you fuck it up, that's fine. But it's another thing, and I've always thought that. You know, that fucking pilot that day, I mean, he didn't have any right to do that with the other three guys that were a corporal whose wife was pregnant, the sergeant's wife had just had a baby, and he didn't have any right to do that shit. So, I don't know. But you know what? I mean, it's been going on right. Since Orville and Wilbur Wright, you know, took off.
There's no argument. So what are you going to do, like take away part of his SGLI that went to... Mexican or what?
No, I mean, at that point, you know, the only thing you're doing is screwing other people. But, you know, it's just, I know, and it's something, you know, in that community, you know, I heard Milstead give his talk once and said, look, the only thing you can do is tie the record for the lowest flight ever. You can't break that thing. So
yeah.
So why do it? You know, just stay away from that shit. But again, it's just, you know, in the investigation, I mean, it's brutal, because, you know, here's an inexperienced pilot, you know, attempting to do something, you know, and trying to prove himself, and it's just unnecessary. It's just stupid. So.
Yeah. There's no defense. I mean, right. Remember when we were, again, back when we were at Iowa State talking, Vitor used to come over, you know, and talk to us. And he was talking one time. He said, hey, you know, I'm talking about just this type of thing, but with infantry guys in combat. He says, you know, if you're going to push, you're going to take a chance, do something, and you break some kind of SOP, that's okay. But if it goes south, you got to have the balls to take responsibility for it.
And the other thing I would say is the juice better be worth the squeeze. You better be able to look somebody in the face and say, this is what we were trying to do. These were the options. I believe that this was the best option to have this effect. And if you can't say that, then, I mean, you know, if you want to go risk your own life, that's fine.
And, like, all that live fire we did at ISC, it was new live fire. I mean, started with, I think, really in earnest with General Kelly when he was the director. There had been challenging live fires before, but nothing like the envelope that he pushed and continued on by General Allen and then through the years to today. But the thing was, sooner or later, someone's probably going to get shot. Sooner or later, a couple of people did through the years. But you had to look at it like every day, you know, is its own day, is its own unique time. And I'm going to do this live fire. It's got a lot of moving parts, and something can happen. And maybe it will happen someday, but not this day, not the day I'm running.
Right.
And because it's important that people know, you know what it's like to get as close as you can get to the actuality of doing field firing without actually being in it before you do it, so that shock doesn't happen. I'm reading this book now about Korea called, no, I can't remember the name of it right now off the top of my head, but it's like it's a new book about that same old stuff, the 1950s. And these guys, I just read the part about Caffaretta again. And to have no experience at all and get shoved into that, you know, it's almost like more than somebody can bear. So the responsibility of us and in their way, the air wingers too, pushing it as far as they can without being stupid about it, you know?
No, and I think that's a great point, Jeff. Is and I'll tell you what, and we all know, right, the due diligence we put in terms of. I remember when I changed the live fire night attack, and so it was instead of doing the old traditional comm wire, and splitting off and getting online, and then, you know, everybody's tied in before you even, I mean, I don't know where that technique came from, but I always used to say, look, if they're that fucked up in the forward edge of their battle area, why don't you just walk up and shoot them while they're sleeping, okay? Because, I mean, who the fuck are you going to be able to do this that has anybody awake up there? And so, so what we did was we backed the attack off another, I don't know, maybe 500 meters across whatever that hardball was and into the far tree line. And on signal, right, we took off running. It was three squads, and the squads were maybe, they were in column, right? So they're in column. So they took off at a sprint across the field. And all we were going to do was immediate action drills. And the danger was where the two squads came together, that there would be overlap, somebody would see somebody, go to shoot a target, somebody hop up to rush, and then shoot them. So, I mean, and we went out there and we walked that stuff. We went, and right, we knew where the AIs had to be, what they had to be looking for. I mean, and we put a shit ton of work to make it realistic so that they would leave with the confidence that we wanted them to have. But, I mean, that's hard. I mean, when you're shooting live ammunition at night and it's non-illuminated, right, or initially it was non-illuminated, then you better have your ass and your brain wired together.
What I liked about that, you're absolutely right. That's one of the first things I saw at ISC. I thought, this is the way to fucking do it.
Right.
That exact thing where you, there'd be, you'd be online, it wouldn't be online, but they'd be in squad columns.
Right.
So when they hit whatever we did to evoke the security position, that's when the attack started, and that's when they move fast and then deploy from columns to a line. And then at that moment, when those first rounds went downrange that the enemy security had been hit, then that's when the word went up to put up supporting arms.
Right.
Because it was basically based on what Terry Allen, who was relieved as a CG in World War II of the Big Red One, he got another division that specialized in night attacks. And they did night attacks in northwestern Europe after D-Day. And I thought it was you, Mac, who had me read that. Tell me about that guy. And then this is what...
I don't know if that's where that idea came from, Jeff, or it was just the only... If it was, hey, look, the only way to do this is to be... And let me just say this for everybody. So what we used to have a three-day fax and a five-day fax, right? And then when I think it was when Major Kelly was still there, or maybe it was right after he left, we kept him out over the weekend, and we created this 10-day war.
That, 2.5.
Yeah.
Great
fax. And initially it was patrolling, and then because we changed the live fire night attack, what we did was we simulated we're going to move to a quote-unquote rear area where we'll provide our own local security, but we're going to train over the course of the weekend. And we did live fire after live fire at night to practice all this shit. And it started with, it was kind of the, we taught it during the day at the basic school. Well, we did the same thing, but we did it at night. And we put special emphasis on, you know, the two squads where you're going to come together. Who are those guys going to be? They've got to know who to look for, right? And they've got to, and so that's the kind of hard, I mean, honestly, that's the kind of detail that you got to put into it or else somebody is going to get hurt.
And it was a heart pumper.
Oh, my God.
Before I left, I see, we kept making everything more realistic. And I know we started using SMAWS on that night attack. And there was a bunker that they were going to shoot at. And Bob Muse, you guys remember him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob's in charge of it. I go, Bob, what if one of these, it was this inert round from SMAWS. I go, what if one of these inert rounds hits the one of the pitch targets instead of the bunker? He goes, Ebrad, it just will bounce off like a bullet. Well, the first time we did it, excuse my French, but we're going, and Jimmy Bright was the AI, and this guy, he was in charge of the he was close to the guy who's, I can't remember who did, was it, to the guy with the SMAW, and the kid shot it, and bigger than shit, he didn't shoot the sandbag bunker. He shot one of the pitch targets because it was dark, you know, and there was a loom going up at that point. You know how we shot the loom once they did the they hit the security part, but it didn't bounce off. It exploded the pitch target. I mean, it hit it like one of those cannonballs in the Civil War, and all those like six metal plates. If you guys remember,
right.
Pain in the acid work,
right? Yeah,
they're airborne, and I'm standing there, and I hear this. Like a pterodactyl coming in. And the plate stuck like all the way down. It was buried in the ground right next to this kid who was in the prone position. I'm like,
holy smoke.
Yeah, I'm like, holy shit. So then we had like a red chem light on the bunker. The red chem light is kind of cheesy. I go, well, pretend it's a signature or something shooting at you, you know. But I remember thinking, holy. And then two classes later when I was in AWS is when the first kid got shot doing that night attack from behind. Just like you said, Mac, during the deploying part, you know?
And after Jeff got the SMAWS worked into that thing, I tried to get M67 frags for the end of that daylight where we fake them out, and then we keep on going across R7, and when I finally got to some kind of board guy, I think he was Indian Head Maryland, he said, I've granted so many goddamn waivers to IOC, I'm not considering another thing. You're not throwing a grenade anywhere near anybody. I mean, it was flat plate. He was like frustrated with us because we just kept on popping them in, and the only thing we lost was the old two gas shot, which we never authorized to begin with anyway.
I learned so much. You know, Mac, you brought up FEX 2.5. That was the first FEX I was ever in charge of at IOC. I learned so much about live fire and all the benefits of doing realistic live fire in a prudent way,
right?
You know, because we did R5, and then we moved everything over to R11.
Right.
And for those folks who don't know what we're talking about, these ranges are miles apart, and the first one's kind of a, we call it squat in the golf course, because it's more or less flat terrain, but the second one is not. And there were two great places to train, but you also were training lieutenants on how to do logistics at that, at right. that baby level, at that right. platoon level, because it was a major, you know, pain, you know, pain, and they had to, and just like you said, Max, the idea was you're setting up the whole thing.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was a very good exercise for that.
You know, in doing it, when I went to Major Allen with the idea of changing, I took the night attack over from Jody Osterman, who's now a lieutenant general. And it had been one of my, I'd read about night attacks and things like that, and it'd been one of my pet peeves about this shit is so stupid. You know, especially in Quantico, there's branches in woods and, you know, people are falling down and stumbling and you're making all kinds of noise. It's just like, good God, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever been a part of, and we're sneaking up on somebody. And so, what I had to, oh God! Yeah, it's like yeah, it is. It's like having a brass band out in somebody's the forward security area. So when I went to him with the idea, I knew that I had to show him how we would train to this level, the standard. And what was really gratifying was when we'd actually be doing the night attack. So we went from range 5 to range 11 to range 15 throughout the course of yeah. Of this evolution, you would see the lieutenants, they, you know, they knew, right? They knew who to look for. And you know, and the whole thing was, if you're not sure where that guy is, don't shoot, move. Just keep moving, yeah. right?
Teaching cohesion.
Right. And so, and that's grown up shooting stuff, right? Because
yep.
you know, your own rounds kill you just as easy, just as good as other rounds kill you. And so it's really interesting to hear them talk, and especially the staff NCOs that would go through it, because they had never been through anything like this. And I remember the first one I heard go through it was like, okay, let me tell you all what I thought about this. When I first heard about this, I thought, you know, if there's anything that I'll ever opt out of, it might be this event. And he said, but this is one of the most motivating training things I've ever done. I never thought a bunch of second lieutenants who are new to the infantry community could do something like this. And he said,
yeah.
that was the best attack I've ever been on in my life. It felt awesome because we knew what we were doing and you could feel it in the attack because of the speed at night. It didn't bog down. It moved. And guys, so anyway, so it was that kind of a solid approach. You know, and no, I love that.
You know, this is funny because you mentioned Killer, and I saw him at Mel's retirement. He looked great, but when we were first doing that extended daylight attack, we had Saudis. We had a couple of Saudi officers in IOC at the time.
Oh yeah.
Right, and so you fake the lieutenants out because they think they're hitting this one range, and it's not that they've got another half mile to go. And they start taking fire, and they're now doing fire and move, but the Saudis weren't keying off. One of them didn't key off, and he fell down and unleashed, I think, 100 saw rounds, and from Killer was right behind him. And from where the way that Killer saw it, he hit me. Because as soon as I started hearing the shit whistling by my ear, I dived to the deck. He hadn't hit me, obviously. But Killer was frantic, running over, Jesus, Tim. I said, no, I'm fine. And, oh, my God, and he wear that kid out, obviously. And I don't believe we ever let another foreign military officer carry a saw again, ever.
I remember that class. It was six
yeah.
guys. Three of them
yeah.
were the wise men because they were like very religious Sunnis.
Mm-hmm.
The other three were just like, you know, regular Saudis. Remember that?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
I had one of them in my mentor group, you know, one of the non-religious men. But you should – do you remember do you remember during Specs 2.5? I don't know if you were still there, Mac. When we started integrating for some reason we started doing the chaos specs during Flex 2.5, and it was dicey because you had to have so much sleep time before you could safely do a live fire, at least 4 hours, you know.
Right.
And so, but Dr. DiGiovanni did his thing where he brainwashed those six or seven guys to be casualties during the chaos specs. One of them was this kid McDonough. I don't know if you guys remember him.
Big guy. Now you remember McDonough, Room of Pain, another one of those painful memories.
Yeah, he just retired. He was he took a team, advisor team, over to Iraq back in 2014. That's the last time I saw him. And then he retired. He retired as, you know, as the...
That's another Navy football lineman.
Yeah. And he was a... His roommate was one of the wise men. And the guy was in tears because he was like a... He had a, you know, broken shoulder, fake, of course, you know. But the guy was in tears because of that. And that's the one where we were breaking Joe Rutledge in. Joe, by accident, hit a guy in the head with one of those big gas grenades. And that, also in that class, was that reserve officer, Captain Salonica. Do you remember Tim, Timmy? He's like...
I do. It's we're not talking about the one where the guy got in a fight with his roommate, because... Giovanni, yeah, because D. Giovanni would put him naked in a barrel, because he'd spend a weekend sitting naked in a barrel to prove he could do it. And then he would have female WMs hit the guy with a cattle prod, not on. And his roommate's watching this. And so D. Giovanni's saying, look, answer my question. Okay, no? Well, we're going to torture your roommate. And this kid's wailing, and he's screaming and crying. And McDonough, and finally the kid goes in, and he tells him everything about the patrol he wants to know, and he's all dejected and whatnot. And then later at the debrief, when D. Giovanni's walking everybody through, because the chaos thing, that's just the start of it. I mean, the chaos thing is a rather a significant event, complete with CS. And and when the kid found out that his roommate had been faking and was in on it, he hit him, and it broke his eye socket, and had to let it back into the
system. Yeah.
And he felt horrible, and I was like, what happens? It's no big deal. Come on, we got effects to go. But that was. But as I recall, after that, we put him in the bag 100% because we're getting ready for the live fire. We said, all right, going to sleep because we're going to do live fire, and you're going to empty every magazine and every little thing. We're going to make sure there's no blanks, and you know we did all the things properly that you have to do to transition from blank to live fire. I thought that was a lesson in and of itself.
Right. Once again, Captain or. The artist formerly known as Captain McNamara has had us talk about pushing the envelope like those air guys did, and the difference in philosophy that that you got to have. It's not for aggrandizement or anything. It's to get as close to the elephant as you can without being reckless. It's for reckless's sake. That's the difference.
Yeah,
I remember Major Allen forcing us to go through every goddamn thing we had, every exemption, everything we thought was in place, and resubmitting it. And we ended up having to resubmit more information to make all of this legit. Because I think prior to that, we were doing a few exercises where we did not have the permits to do what we were doing. The flue gas shot being one, but that wasn't an IOC thing. That was a
basic school thing.
Yeah, the best thing, and again, it was invented while Mac was there with General Kelly, that movement to contact through that, and especially during the spring and summer, it was like doing movement to contact Cow River and Guadalcanal.
Yeah, for people that don't know what we're talking about, General Kelly, and I don't know who it might have been, Stacy Clarity, because I think he was honcho in it when I went over to IOC, and I remember. It was probably the second class that I put through in the summer. Major Allen had come down because he was going to take over the group, and Major Kelly was leaving. And so what they did was you were moving through the woods in Quantico, and the targets were balloons, right? So they'd be sometimes moving in the breeze and all that kind of stuff, but they weren't easy to hit. And so, you know, it's the whole marksmanship thing of no shit. With all your gear on, you're moving, your heart stomping, and here's a stupid yellow balloon that everybody's missing, and you can't move. And in the vegetation of Quantico, so the engagements aren't happening at very long distances. And so and that has an impact on how much you can, you know, not be online. If the engagements are going to happen, you know, at close range. So, but that was the first event that Major Allen had ever seen at IOC. And he came down from the Naval Academy where he was working. And, you know, Mac, how are you? And the first time I had met him, hey, sir, I'm fine. And I was just nobody AI and helping out. we got ready to do that. And I remember thinking, what the hell must he think Kelly's got him into? But it was great training. The lieutenants loved it, right? Because
yeah.
It made them really think about what they were doing and exercise it and having to take into consideration how dense the vegetation was and the impact that had real world of how dispersed we could be if we're going to be deadly and not shoot ourselves at the same time. And so it was good.
Yeah.
It was good. And I'll tell you what. And
well,
every
PZ for that initially when you guys were doing it.
Right. And every one of those, every one of the live fire shoots that we did at IOC had that kind of intellectual rigor in it. And that's why they were also, you know, they tended to, I don't know, I wouldn't say push the envelope. It was push what was traditionally done, right? But I think that there was not anything that we did that I wasn't comfortable doing, you know, and what it really got back to is, well, if we're going to do that, then we've got to train to this. And if we train to this, then that's not going to be difficult. And that's what that's what really changed was the intermediate steps we had to do. But again, it was just better. It was better, more realistic training. And as the point you made earlier, Jeff, it wasn't reckless. You know, it wasn't reckless.
What live fire assaults, squad assaults, and platoon assaults, what that does is it teaches restraint. It teaches when to shoot and when not to shoot. And there's almost nothing else you do other than driving that into people's heads that does that. And so it even has an effect for when you're talking about operations, you know, in a coin environment, when, you know, there's not much difference between not shooting a kid and not shooting your buddy who's rushing, you know?
Right, no.
And we go back to the day of 9-1-1, and where was Jeff heading in his gubby? To Fort Benning to try to, because they wanted to force down on us some kind of bullshit FATS training system, because no doubt we're taking casualties in training. I'll bet.
Yep.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that didn't happen.
A kid got shot in the live fire mech attack, which I invented. And he got shot during there was an assault that basically was the same assault that you did during the night attack, but you came out of AAVs, you crossed MCB-5, whatever it was. It was there at R-15, one of the many ranges around the R-15 area. And finally, a guy just wasn't obeying one of the four safety rules and shot his buddy in the leg who was rushing in front of him. And so that's when, and I was still at command staff when that happened. But that kind of, you know, pushed them to send me down there. And then we didn't make it because of 9-11 and then because of 9-11, the CEO of the base said, all that extra live fire you want to do, just fucking do it.
And there you go. And there it is. Because you're going to lose. I mean, you don't have to lose people, but you're going to get people shot. I mean, it's just going to happen.
Yeah, that live fire moving to contact was a masterful thing. The only thing we changed on that, Mac, was what the balloons are just there. And sometimes the lieutenants wouldn't hit the range at the right angle.
Right.
So remember, we're always thinking of realistic ways to make them hit it. So again, we came up with the enemy's going to have security out, and if you don't hit that security, you know. And then we had those little Russian men that were like, they're like oblong.
Yeah.
I put those up in the trees with the balloons attached to them. So the balloons are still blowing around. You know, they're still on strings and stuff. And the balloon represented the signature of the enemy's weapon, really.
Right. But the good thing about the balloons was that they moved, right? And they were not, you know, and the things that you were teaching, you know, was, you know, and you had, and there again, there's artificialities involved in it. You know, as Jeff said, you're trying to make this thing realistic, right? You don't have cones on the left and right, so you're trying to like drop bread to get them to go the point to go a certain way,
right?
And, which sets up the whole range span and the whole attack really. But what you were asking them to do, as Jeff was saying, was, you know, shoot, not shoot. What's the criteria for that? I have to have it in my head. And no shit, real stuff. Were the people on my left and my right? Not just let's just go shoot and we'll be online. And it was way more realistic. And they came away way more mature, you know, relative to you know, the real world lessons that you have to learn about your own situational awareness so you don't kill your own guys.
It's a masterful stroke that staff NCOs, particularly staff sergeants, you know, once in a while through the course. You get ahead, you know, because they were the ones that, because I was one of those guys when I was a second lieutenant, and then when I was basically a promoted first lieutenant, as they used to call us, non-company commander captains at IOC, I was one of those dudes who was a staff NCO and everything. And I was like, holy shit, now I understand how this stuff can be a lot better. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but we go back to the cultural thing, right? Because those of us that are going to, I'm sorry, I've got to channel a little bit of Barenbach here, but the kind of guy that's going to go to the fringes of the free world, right, and fight there. We're not, like, responsible citizen soldiers. I would say we're not often responsible, but how do you temper down the enthusiasm?
That's, right. Oh, you know? By the way, exactly. By the way, that guy, that book's On Desperate Ground. You just remind me when you said Barenbach. He didn't write it, but remind me of the title.
Barenbach crisis down here.
That's what made it, you know. You know, I'll never forget when I went over to IOC from the basic school. And, I mean, I was so excited, you know, to be one of the people that you get chosen to go there. And, it's, you know, it's not everybody's dream when you go back there is, you know, maybe to be an instructor there. And you know, but it was the intellectual rigor, you know, of the range bands and how do we do it and how do we do it safe and what are we going to tell them and how do we set it up. And then, and it was one of the, I mean, it was one of the coolest jobs I've ever had. And it made, and then leaving all of that after I was there for like 3.5 years. After being there for like 3.5 years, to go and be a company commander was nothing. To organize training.
Isn't that the truth?
It was the easiest. I had more fun as a company commander. It was the easiest job in the world because you had done this stuff in this laboratory where, again, you tried to make training as realistically as humanly possible. And now I think of when I see those automated targets that use artificial intelligence to talk to each other, I think of, man, if you could be at IOC now, you know, you could lay in a defense and you could have it attacked, right? And then have a secondary attack from a different angle, all automated, all with targets that register, all that with targets that talk to each other. I was thinking, wow, how cool would that be? But again, what you're, I mean, and the, just so everybody knows, the basis of all of this, you know, is the moral obligation that we have to the young, to the families that whose sons and daughters go become, you know, Marine infantrymen. And that their job is to locate close with, and that we send out the best, you know, trained lieutenants in the world, and the Marine Corps does, in terms of what they're capable of, what their level of maturity is, and that they're fully capable. And we all took that, you know, deadly serious. And I remember I used to teach the decision class on the first day, and I said, you know, what gives you the right to sit here today? And somebody would say, well, you know, we're college educated. And I said, yeah, anybody who's gone to college, right, knows that maybe in one day in our nation's history that was the mark of a man cut from a higher bolt of cloth, but not any longer, right? And so, what you have to do here is every day you have to fucking earn the respect of your peers. And you have to earn the mantle that if everybody in your platoon takes a rank off, everybody points to you and says, we want him, you know, in charge because that's our best bet. And I said, and I used to do this thing where, you know, the people that are going to give you their kids, they think of a mantle. There's a baby picture to the right of that. There's probably a Little League or Pop Warner picture. There's high school prom pictures. Then there's a picture of that kid, you know, in his dress blues at the recruit depot. Whether they have any more pictures to the right of that may be a function of your ability to lead. And you've got to do that. You've got to take that seriously because it's a life and death responsibility. And we took it as such. And that's why it made it so fun. And, you know, that's where, you know, I met these guys, And you've heard, you know, you've heard other people that worked there and with us. It was just a great intellectual experience as well as training experience. And those two things would mesh in our live fires stuff. And they were awesome. They were awesome, man. And it was a great time.
And the other thing was live fire took all of us out there to AI the thing, because you need to have safety officers out there.
Yeah.
So that not only bred, that was a lot of fun for us to hang out, sit around and shoot the ship, but the lieutenants saw that too. So there was never any, you know, we didn't sit there and say, you've got to be committed and work like extra hours. We never said that. We just did
it.
And they always saw us and they knew.
You know, as a inspector, I had a guy, I've never heard of this before, but he comes to me, he says, sir, I think I can't do this. I'm working too many hours and my wife's, you know, not being able to handle it. And I looked at him like he had a dick thrown out of his head. Excuse me. And I know that I had picked up between Bronzy and Greeley and Jeff Kenney Jr., this guy, they weren't liking him too much. You know how you pick up when you go to the live fires and stuff, you watch the training. And so I'm trying to talk to him, and I was going through a divorce at the time from my first wife. And I go, look, man, this is where I'm good at talking to lieutenants. I'm good at talking to troops, but I'm not good at talking to a guy who's having problems with his marriage. And this is how I found it out, because I said, look, man, it's bad when your wife leaves you, but it's not all bad. And now he looked at me like I had a D growing out of my head, right? And I thought, ooh, perhaps. But anyways, he left. We didn't fire him. I mean, it's kind of a,
right.
But he left, you know, and he's a good guy. I think he retired. Last time I saw him, he was lieutenant colonel. So, you know, because what Timmy's talking about, it becomes a real, you're either one of the men or you ain't, you know, and everybody who's an instructor there pretty much is, you know.
Well,
that's
how
you got there.
And that was only, you know, and just what the work we did, you know, I tell people, I don't drink much, right? And people say, well, when did you stop drinking? And I said, well, when I think about it, I stopped drinking at the basic school in IOC because when I would go home, right, you had to read, right? And,
yeah.
And so, you know, you go home and you've been outdoors all day and you have a couple of beers. I mean, I'd be asleep. So that's when I stopped drinking, because what we did during the day and even at work, right, I'd go home and you have dinner and your kids go to bed. And then, you know, you're up reading Fehrenbach, you're up reading Night Attack, you're up reading Iwo Jima, you're up reading, you know, Mech Tactics, or, you know, what is that book, The Valley of Tears, by the Israeli general. It talks about the attack into the Baca Valley and whatnot. And so, you know, you read all that stuff because these guys would come through and we'd meet them and you'd say, well, let me see what I can learn, and maybe I can take something out of the book and involve it in either the way I teach or one of our fexes. And it was for those of us who liked it, it was the best between the guys you worked with, and that's where I really got smitten by the ensemble creative thing that I still enjoy even with post-traumatic winning. I enjoy, you know, other people's takes and have you thought about this and what do you think of that? And I've never gotten over, after initially experiencing it with smart people that are dedicated and how good you can make. I've never gotten over that experience.
Hey, I want to dispel any notions amongst the audience that this was all collegial or whatnot, because a murder board, you had a new class and you were going through a murder board, that, my friends, was not a pleasant experience. Not even close.
Yeah.
That's how you got sharp. It's like a comedian getting heckled. You know, you either quit or you get sharper. But murder boards, particularly with you, Mr. McNamara, not pleasant. Not pleasant at all.
Come on, man. I never... I think that was more reputation than actual deed. Well, no, let me tell you, though. When you walked into murder board, and think about this. Lou Caparata, Phil Smith, you know, Jody Osterman, John Kelly. Yeah, you're gonna show your ass in front of them, right? Or, and then for you guys, you know, it was John Allen, you know, me, Right, and I don't know who the hell.
Yeah, it was Paul Kennedy, Stacy Clarity.
Right. Those
herbivore.
Yeah, and you were proud and you wanted to show that you could do it. And so, I mean, there was a lot of pressure on, and again, what in my opinion was, other than maybe some, hey, you kind of taught it this way, I think it's best taught this way, and those are just teaching points, but really what you were looking for is, has the guy put the intellectual rigor into it? He'll get it right, right? But that was the major thing to me that you looked at is, has he done the due diligence? And we never had an issue with that because everybody wanted to be there. And again, you know, John Allen sitting in there or John Kelly. And they were heavyweights. They came with these gigantic reputations, being great leader and great infantrymen. And they expected a lot out of you, and you wanted to give it to them. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And I will tell you what, the other thing was, it was the most nervous I ever saw my peers, because they didn't want to...
Wait, a herbivore?
They didn't want to fuck it up. They don't want to show your ass in front of that group and be judged not worthy to be here. Yeah, that wasn't... Those aren't the people we're talking about.
Yeah.
It was good, though. It was good.
Right.
It was good. But again, yeah. What got us here was... was the whole discussion about the difference between, you know, pushing envelopes and training, that is our responsibility, I think, and then being reckless in training. And there's a difference. And the difference isn't slight either. The difference is a pretty wide, significant difference. And so it's just, that investigation. If you get a chance, Jeff, read, there's a good article in U.S. Naval Institute News, and there's another one in Marine Corps Times did a pretty good piece on it, but pretty interesting.
I will. I'm going to be in the Citadel, as a matter of fact. I'm going to be in South Carolina for the next couple of days till Monday afternoon, but I will get it as soon as I can.
Yeah, are you, is that on business, or are you going to see family, or what?
My kid who works for Boeing, who was a grunt in 1/6, and his first battalion commander was Assad, and then he had Journey, so he did Iraq and Afghanistan, and then he decided to learn how to do something for a living. So him and another guy went learned nuke power plants for avionics up in Detroit, and he makes a shitload of money now. He's doing good.
Oh, awesome! And he's down in Charleston.
Yeah.
No, I've heard nothing but great. Two cities I've heard nothing but great things about are Charleston and San Antonio.
We did a 2X in Charleston back when I was at SOTG. Landed a helicopter right outside the Citadel in the middle of a Friday night. Fucking amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. F-53.
I've never F-53. Never been to either one of them.
Yeah. It was. I didn't see much of the city because we were.
Let me ask you a final question. Have you read any? What's the best book? And if you haven't, then that's fine. But what's the best book you've ever read about the Hanoi Hilton?
Oh, let me think. There's a couple of them. The one, When Hell Was in Session by...
Denton?
Denton, yeah.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking of.
And, you know, I read that again when I was on ship, when I was Greenwoods 3 on the 15th view. But I read a lot then. I mean, I look back and wonder how I had the time, because the guy kept me pretty busy. But that one, and you know what else is a good one about the Hanoi Hilton? There's a book that James Webb wrote, a fiction book, called... it was about three guys who graduated from the Naval Academy in, like, the late 40s. One of them went to Korea.
Country Such as This.
Yes, A Country Such as This. And the Hanoi Hilton part was pretty good. One of the guys, Red, was a POW. And, you know, so a lot of stuff that come out during post-traumatic winning that you talk about, Mac, I first got an inkling of from Webb during that. You know, he wasn't thinking of it in those terms, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
And the guy's a great writer, you know, so it's like, it was very, you know, compelling.
Right, right. Timmy?
Good ones for me.
I knew about the Denton book. I've read the Webb book, and I suspect that if I were to recommend a book, it'd be the one that you've been talking about the last couple of days. Because I have not read specifically on the Handel Hilton, other than in the fictional accounting from Jim Webb.
Well, is there a book, Mac, that's like...
Well, I'll tell you what. The first one I read that was pretty compelling was Lessons from the Henry Hilton, Six Characteristics of High Performance Teams. But... it's by a guy named Peter Fretwell, and I listen to him. I don't read him. So while I'm working, I put him on. But I've really enjoyed it. I enjoyed that book. The other one I listened to most of it today is called 6 Years in the Hanoi Hilton, an extraordinary story of courage and survival, and it's written by Amy Shively Hawk. Her father, the forged by John McCain, her father is named Jim Shively. And he was a POW there for 6 years. And it's a pretty detailed account, starting, you know, when he was a kid and taking him through his capture and whatnot. But I've enjoyed both of them. And I've kind of mixed Frankel in between because, you know, the strains of Frankel and, you know, man's search for meaning and finding meaning in life, you know, run through and the whole transformative experience that those... that the Hanoi Hilton prisoners had is amazing. One of the most amazing parts of it is, I want to say, there's like 20 guys who they take out just before they're released, and they put in a place called Alcatraz. And they were told to, you know, get on buses, and they wouldn't get on buses because they thought it was a ruse. And that part is really fascinating. And said, no, you're being released. And they said, we're not going anywhere. And then they looked at the group and said, hey, you know, you're being released. Whoever wants to get on the bus can get on the bus. And nobody made a move, right? And so it's you see this incredible story of their devotion to each other and what they perceived as their mission, which is return with honor. And the stories are really incredible. So I would recommend either one of those, Lessons at the Hanoi Hilton or 6 Years in the Hanoi Hilton. Both of them I've read are really interesting. So, you know, interesting story of transformation. And that story is only half the story because the other half of the story is what they do when they come back, you know, on a backside of that and the way they're experience, the way they transformed each other, the way they learned to deal with it, changed the way they looked at life. And I'll tell you what, and the other thing that I love is a quote that I heard from Viktor Frankl this week, and where he's talking about freedom. And he says, freedom is only half the story and part of the truth. He said, the other half is responsibility. He said,
right.
That's why I encourage the United States to build a statue of responsibility on the West Coast to balance out the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast. Right?
Awesome,
right. And I just, you hear that and you're like, wow, what a great...
They give it to us, like the French gave us the Statue of Liberty. The Israelis or the South Koreans should give us that one.
Yeah, no kidding. But you hear that and you're like, wow, that's rich. That's rich stuff.
Well,
so anyway.
I mean, that's a good thing, Mac, that you brought up, because that's what's missing when people talk about, you know, freedom. Our parents, I mean, the one thing that's drilled into me was you got a responsibility to everybody else that you come in contact with. Like, you know, one of the things that would mortify them would be if I acted out in public and inconvenienced some stranger, like on a bus or in a restaurant. And I had the same feeling with my kids. It's like, yeah, you're free to do stuff. You got a responsibility to that person you don't know who's a fellow American who's going through this place with you, you know, and that's one of the many responsibilities you have, but that's one of the most basic ones, where you can't raise people and have them think. And I think we got that problem today, where they are the most important individual who ever was born, you know, and that's a great idea. The idea of not only, with freedom comes responsibility. You're responsible for things with what you do with that.
And Frankel's an interesting dude. And I mean, he's corresponding with Freud when he's a teenager, and
right.
he And he essentially rejects the Freudian approach that man's an animal and reverts to his most basic instincts. And mm-hmm. he even gets after Freud in one of his things, and he said, you know, Dr. Freud interviewed his subjects on a leather couch in beautiful offices, right? My subjects were in a concentration camp, lying in straw that was soaked in urine and feces. And, you know, and he said, and I dare say that man doesn't revert, you know, to this uniform animal instinct, that man behaves as distinct as ever, and he will choose between whether he's noble or whether he's, you know, whether he behaves like an animal. And so, I mean, he says some very pointed stuff. It's awesome.
He's a hero, because the two most damaging philosophers we've had in our history as humans is Freud and Marx. Those two guys have caused more misery because people religiously grab hold of their stuff, and they, you know, it's just not well thought out, if you ask me.
And I tell you what, neither Freud nor Marx could have sucked up 6 years of isolation in the North Vietnamese prison.
Yeah.
That's for damn sure. Because it's remarkable. It's, you have to think, those guys were spending, some of them, months and months at a time in total isolation. And what the hell do you have inside you that allows you to function through that? I'm telling you.
You want to know what it is?
Yeah.
Because there's another great quote that Frankl has. It's the belief in your country and the righteousness of your cause. And one of the things that Frankl talks about is man's, in man's search for meaning, which is the broad really theme of his work, right? And one of the things he says is, look, we no longer have to band together for our own security. You know, we have people, we pay people to provide security. We no longer have to work together to produce our food. And so, as a result, we have more and more, you know, discretionary time. And so, consequently, people are searching for meaning in their lives. Now, he's doing this stuff in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and he's developing his thesis. And so, when he gets to the 60s and 70s, he's saying these things. Well, if it was true then, it's about a billion times more true today.
That
with a purpose, no matter where you come with meaning in your life, no matter where you come from economically, you will give your life up for that purpose. And conversely, you will take your own life, no matter your economic circumstance, if your life is meaningless. And so he says, you know, so the key thing in life is to find meaning. And if with meaning, you can endure anything. So I'm a fan. I'm a fan, and I became a fan unwittingly, right? I didn't know that, I mean, because there's no mistake where this has to go, and then you start reading Frankl, and you're like, holy shit, right? Holy shit. And you hear the things he says and his experiences in the concentration camp, and then he starts reading you letters from prisoners in penitentiaries. I have found so much meaning in my life here as I've begun to help others after I've read your works. And it's just like, holy shit, man. It's very cool stuff. Very cool stuff. And he's very respectful to Freud, I think, who he has great respect for. And he said, because man does have animal instinct and man, you know, is part animal. But at the end of the day, between stimuli response, there's a space. And in that space, we exercise our humanity. We exercise our freedom. We exercise our responsibility by the way we choose. And that's what makes us fundamentally different, and it makes us fundamentally different 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so I think it's really... and then the other thing I think is, if you're looking for the answer for people that are rudderless, it isn't in a medication. In fact, he talks about when he was helping students in college at the University of Vienna before the Second World War, when they would be struggling with no meaning in their life, no purpose, he would say, okay, I'm going to take you down to volunteer. And they would volunteer at soup kitchens, and they would volunteer at, you know, with people that had serious mental illnesses. And he said, and all of a sudden, they would have found purpose. So, It's cool stuff. Cool stuff.
Yep.
And I read that book 20 years ago when my mom passed, and I didn't remember enough of it to connect to what you've been saying. I've been listening to you for over a year now, and it's funny how they kind of mesh. It's not a mystery to me, because you know I think there's only one way through these type of things.
I would not have said that there's only one way, but I believe that now. There's not a drug that somebody can give you that is going to make some of the things that we've all lived through go away. There's not. You can't talk enough, right? To talk, going to find somebody's head, you know, to a good place. Those amount of words don't exist, right? But you can get yourself to a good place if you'll give of yourself and change the lives of others. And to me, it's as basic, you know. And I mean, there were 3 suicides on the Bush this week. And you know, and you're looking at the different approaches, and
that's
brutal. It's brutal.
I've never heard anything like it.
Yeah,
never heard anything like it.
And so, I would not have come to these conclusions before, but now, to me, like I know the answer now. And people will go, "Oh, Mac, whatever." No. I know it because I've seen it happen so many times. I had a corporal call this week because he had another person in his life die, and he had already had a bunch, and he called me, and he's doing the right things because he knows the truth. And you see how powerful the truth is, and that challenge to, hey, look, you know, it's not good enough that you change you got to help other people. And then by doing that becomes shepherds, and then when they become shepherds, it changes their behavior. And so instead of going off and being isolated and doing stupid shit, what do? They pick up the phone and say, "Hey, man, can I talk to you?" And it's the best. So,
yeah.
Victor Frankl.
Yeah.
Check him out. All right, boys. Any final thoughts before you head off to Charleston?
No, just that I'm gonna get Frankl on my Kindle while I'm out there.
Yeah, download the audiobook and just you can listen to. You could probably finish it in one flight.
Maybe.
Unless Lori wants to talk, but
she ain't going.
Oh,
she's going Indian.
All right, then you can knock it out. All right, Timmy, any final thoughts?
No, I just, T.R. Fehrenbach has been under attack in a local press for the history of Texas. Other than that, everything's good.
All right. You know, Timmy, and this is the extent of this stuff that happens, especially to me, by way of my friends. But Timmy went to that, you know, veteran adrenaline camp. And designed to promote camaraderie, reconnect, and that you're supposed to go home and continue to go reconnect with your friends when you get home and spread, you know, and help yourself in that manner. But you know, what Tim did was he put me in touch with the woman who runs this thing, and you know, and we talked about, can you imagine if they left with post-traumatic winning under their arm, going back home to change people's lives with these fundamental truths that come out of our culture, you're teaching them to fish for life. And so it's not just a weekend. They're going to learn it over the course of the weekend, but you're going to have a chance to fundamentally change their lives. And so that's, to me, I spoke of the ensemble thing that we have been doing together for a long time, and now it's kind of exciting to do it again and in a life and death kind of event. And so we keep doing it, so it's pretty cool. So anyway, boys, thanks for the visit as always.
Thank you, brother.
Oorah, thanks.
All right, oorah. More of Armory Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.